The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Chris Cotron is the founder and president of the Platypus Affiliated Society. He is also the author of the rather infamous essay, Why Not Trump? And other essays such as The Millennial Left is Dead and Democratic Revolution and the Contradiction of Capital. In this episode of the Zero Books podcast, we discuss the Trump administration's first year and the left's various panicked reactions to what Cotron says is a moment of transition for capitalism itself and U.S. politics in particular. We've moved the Inside Zero Books podcast to Patreon. This will make it easier to get the members-only podcast on podcatchers. It also means that we'll be repeating the first year of Inside Zero Books intermittently on our Patreon account. If you missed Inside Zero Books the first time, the first year, or if you just want to hear the old episodes again, they'll be available. In fact, I'll be posting a rerun of the Inside Zero Books podcast entitled The Zizek Debrief just as soon as this episode is live. If you haven't already, you might pick up Anselm Jaffe's The Writing on the Wall or Ian Parker's Revolutionary Keywords for a New Left. In this episode, you'll hear clips from a BBC report on Donald Trump's genius and mental stability, an excerpt of a cable news interview with Bernie Sanders, and the Negative Land classic collage, Richard Nixon Died Today. Right now, you're listening to a MIDI version of Daft Punk's Harder, Faster, Stronger. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Cotron and I discuss President Wrecking Ball. How are things going with Platypus these days? And do you still feel as though Platypus is a very controversial organization on the left now, or do you feel that people are coming around to rethinking Trump and backing away from their original fears about fascism, proto-fascism?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that we've gone through a few different phases over the past year of the left's response to Trump, and things have moved pretty quickly. The anti-fascist moment seems to have been eclipsed by the sexual harassment concerns.
Right.
And so they seem to be going systematically through all the different ways in which they can try to, you know, the Democrats try to disqualify the Trump presidency. Russia, fascism, sexual harassment. Now, as far as Platypus is concerned, you know, we're doing very well. We're continuing to grow our events on these matters. We've put on a series of events on anti-fascism, have been very successful. And so we've been carrying on engaging the left in their considerations and debates on these matters. Whatever controversy there might have been before the election, I think that there's been a lot less controversy around Platypus regarding Trump after the election. I think that the controversy was really before the election, because I think that the fears have changed. In other words, the anxiety before the election and the anxieties after the election have shifted a little bit. And I think that now it's all about electing Democrats in 2018 as opposed to trying to get Hillary elected in 2016.
Now, would you say that the far left, whatever that is, has had a consistent response to the election of Trump? Because I feel like we get kicked around a lot. People keep changing their positions to follow the Democrats' lead.
That's right. And I would say that, as we discussed previously, I think we talked about this, you know, there's a mixed response to Hillary's defeat, Trump's victory. On the left, there is a large soft-on-Trump contingent out there, whether it's Noam Chomsky or Tariq Ali. You know, there are a bunch of people out there who are soft-on-Trump out of anti-imperialism. And who knows, that might change, you know, with the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. You know, even though people forget that Obama made the same pitch during the primaries in 2008, he promised to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel as well. The fact that Trump actually did it as opposed to promising to do it, which the Democrats have done previously without actually doing it, I don't know whether that will change people's positions because Israel-Palestine is such a hot-button issue. But I, you know, I've noticed that there is still a kind of soft-on-Trumpism on the left that's significant. There's obviously also the other side of the left, broadly speaking, the anti-fascist left, as opposed to the anti-imperialist left that has kept the drumbeat against Trump pretty consistently from before the election until after, up till now. But there is a shift, I think, in terms of the prominence of the left in terms of street demonstrations and whatnot, that now it's, you know, like with anti-fascism, it was the RCP, it was Workers' World, it was the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Whereas in past times, like around the Iraq anti-war movement, those groups were present, but much more prominent were the ISO and others. You don't see the ISO out there on the front lines of anti-fascism, and I think that's because they're soft on Trump.
Is there a political or ideological consistency that determines whether or not someone is soft on Trump? Is it, or is it just a kind of anti-imperialism, which can be found, I think, in a variety of different ideologies or different political stances?
It's not particularly consistent. I mean, my own take on these things is that every major historical shift is a crisis for the left. And so it not only brings out long-standing divisions on the left, but also creates new ones and creates splits among thin previously existing tendencies. So generally speaking, it's a crisis for every organization and every tendency. Every historical shift of capitalism is a crisis. And that's, you know, that's just in the nature of things because one has to change direction. Now, in a broader sense, of course, this speaks to the crisis in the Democratic Party, meaning the crisis of the Obama coalition, if you will, that Hillary tried to inherit, which is to say the way the Democrats hold together different constituencies, organized labor, minority groups, women, gays. Obviously, any historical shift reopens the negotiated alliance that exists there. It sort of poses things in a new way so that, you know, maybe suppressed differences come out.
Do you feel that what was holding together the radical left in the United States before this shift and before the crisis was maybe an unstated or even partially denied commitment to the Democratic Party?
I think that different tendencies on the left tail different factions of the Democrats. The Democrats are a collection of different interest groups, and different left tendencies tail after, follow, adapt to, orient towards, to use a term that you hear on the left, orientation towards different aspects of the Democratic Party coalition. And so you get, like, you know, Solidarity and the ISO have more of an organized labor kind of orientation. Workers' World, RCP, PSL have more of a minority community constituency group orientation. Generally speaking, they're oriented towards different factions of the Democrats. And so they tail after the Democrats, however, differentially, because the Democrats aren't just one thing.
Is that avoidable? Even revolutionary groups do this, right? Is that just because that's where power is? If you're trying to have any political influence at all, you're sort of forced into this position? Or do you feel that this is a mistake that is just being repeatedly made?
I think it's a mistake. I think it is avoidable. I think that these are not revolutionary groups, none of them, because they don't have an orientation towards building political power. And, you know, the only way to make any inroads or make any advances on that front would be to cut across the political divisions that exist in capitalist politics and to Even if one were to have a positive orientation towards the different factions of the Democratic Party, one would still have to reconstitute the relation between minority groups and organized labor, women, gays, racial minorities. Like the way the Democrats over the last generation have managed that social interest aggregation have to be fundamentally reconfigured. In other words, a different basis for that. You know, we'd have to go beyond the Rainbow Coalition. It would have to be reconceived. And of course, it would have to reach out to people who are not Democrats, who might support the Republicans sometimes. And obviously, more than half of the eligible voters don't even vote. And so there's a whole untapped constituency for politics out there that both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, depend upon their passivity and their inactivity. And obviously, the working class is hugely apolitical, depoliticized. And so obviously, just at a very basic level, any actual socialist politics in the United States would have to politicize people in new ways. And that's what they've stopped doing since the 30s. Really, since in the 60s, there were some attempts in that direction. Really, since the 30s, the idea is that the left tries to be a kind of left wing of the Democrats.
What do you mean by politicize people? Do you mean and get them involved in alternative parties?
Yeah, I mean organizing them, organizing people, and organizing people politically, meaning not, you know, again, labor organizing is fine in terms of economic interest, but political organizing. You know, there was a time when, you know, way back when, they like to say the Reds built the unions, right? And that's true, but it also that turns into something else in terms of the Communist Party and the CIO, the history in the United States. But the industrial organizing initiative was something that originated, as opposed to the trade craft orientation of labor organizing, was something that was initiated by the old Socialist Party of America before World War I. And then by the time it got taken up by the CIO later, it already really was just an adjustment to the needs of capitalism, meaning the old craft unions didn't really correspond to the actual concrete situation of labor and capitalism, and industrial unionism made more sense as a collective bargaining thing. It lost its radicalism that it had in the pre-World War I period. I mean, again, generally speaking, organizing people, but not just organizing people, certainly not just in their economic interest, organizing them politically, building a political party. And this has been in the air. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that really struck me since last we spoke was the DSA convention that took place here in Chicago, how much of a bubble that was, meaning we're really probably not going to hear of it ever again.
Why is that? What do you think has gone wrong with the DSA? That does seem to be falling apart. I'm watching some of the leaders in the DSA, or at least some of the people who are big on Facebook, go to war against each other.
I would say that it's because the same reason that there is in the Democratic Party, meaning the DSA just is the Democratic Party, whatever individuals might fool themselves into thinking. There are recriminations. In other words, I think that what people are processing now is defeat of Hillary in the election of Trump. There's mutual recrimination. People are blaming each other. And that has ramifications on the left. Even at some ostensible distance from the Democratic Party, the same recriminations redound.
I mean, so far I haven't gotten to any of the questions I prepared for you, but I'm really interested in this.
The Bernie Bros, right? The Bernie Bros. Were the Bernie Bros responsible for Hillary's defeat? It comes down to that. Right. And the fact that socialists are Bernie Bros, that's an uncomfortable fact. Right. What to do with these straight white guys. Right.
But let's go through some of the other, I mean, reasons that people might have, because the Bernie Bros have their own accusation.
Yep.
They say, you know, the problem is that Hillary abandoned the Rust Belt. The problem was that we put Hillary Clinton up as our candidate. We were cheated out of the chance to run a real campaign against this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, a legitimate
sure.
grief. And that's where I would tend to land if I were entering into the fray of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other you know, accusations to be made. Like, for instance, the Obama administration and certainly Clinton didn't really have any positive agenda for black people in America. And that, the, you know, they had abandoned the immigrants to a large extent.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that, you know, the usual antinomy that we live with in the post-60s era is, you know, and this played during the primaries between Sanders and Clinton, was class versus the accusation of economic reductionism. So what Hillary said was that, you know, breaking up the banks on Wall Street won't help black people. To which, you know, Sanders said, well, it's it might in some way. In other words, that's not like his exclusive program, you know, but it certainly is something that's important. This is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the old class versus race, class versus gender, class versus sexuality, the old problems from the 60s. They've never gotten over it, and there's no end in sight. It seems like that's just the way people understand politics. You just fall into these camps and you're either prioritizing race, gender, and sexuality, or one of those, or you're prioritizing class. And it's very unclear what any of that means. I don't think that you can just prioritize class in a straightforward way. And, you know, even Sanders, right, he was very clear that he didn't want to prioritize one over the others. He just didn't want class, as he understood it, to be left out.
Now, the problem I have with the way that the class versus race or class versus gender conversation tends to go is that they're argued about as if we're talking about constituencies when we talk about class and groups of people. Mm-hmm. But class is not a group of people. It's a position that anybody can take. Mm-hmm. Regardless of their ethnicity or their gender or anything else in society, it's a structure rather than. So, but we seem unable. We talk a lot about structures, but we seem unable to talk seriously about them.
Well, because there's no way that the Democrats are ever going to address structures. I mean, that's, you know, that's the reason people will talk about. Even Hillary talked about structural racism. But all that that means is that there's a Trump card, forgive the pun, that you can always pull out, right? You can always say it doesn't matter if you're personally racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic, you're part of a structure of oppression, and therefore you should shut up and just listen to our policy proposals. You know, but again, how do we understand class if it's understood just as economic interest, right? The old Marxist socialist notion of class was much more thoroughgoing. It was much more about the way people are, you know, not just economically exploited, but really politically disenfranchised, regardless of the fact that they have the vote, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so again, it could encompass these other concerns, right? I like the way Adolf Reed puts it. You know, he says, "Look, what happened in the '60s was a shift from social democracy to racial democracy."
Right.
Right. Whatever limitations there were to the way social democracy was understood, and there were severe limitations to that, still it was pretty much thrown overboard in favor of racial democracy, which is the Democratic Party's comfort zone going back to the 19th century. That's their comfort zone. They were always big on this. They were the party of the Catholics, whatever.
Donald Trump has taken to Twitter again in the latest riposte against claims made in a new book about his administration. The US president says two of his greatest assets have been mental stability and being really smart. He adds he went from being a very successful businessman to a top TV star to president at his first attempt, a route he concludes has resulted in him being a very stable genius. The early morning posts are clearly another sign of Trump's frustration. Washington commentators say there's growing concern on both sides about Trump's house of cards.
It seems to me like Trump has been very much sidelined, that he's been reduced to just being a Twitter warrior as the U.S. establishment regains control. But I don't know if I understand what his actual agenda is or what's important to him. It's very difficult to figure that out.
It's I've tried to formulate it as post-neoliberalism. And of course, you know, what's involved in that concept is two things that are difficult to hold together, which is continuity and change. Meaning, I think he wants some changes, but I think the changes are pretty slight. And I also think the changes are more or less inevitable, meaning that these are changes that probably would have come about even if Hillary had been elected. Meaning a reorganization of global trade, negotiation of immigration. You know, he wants things like, you know, a middle tax class tax break, so-called, which is an interesting phenomenon because actually what it is a tax increase for the middle class and a tax break for the rich and for the poor. So, for instance, I will get a significant tax break from what's being floated now. And, you know, as will a lot of working class people, whereas the coastal elites, the middle class that supports the Democrats, will be hit pretty hard. In other words, the people in the 200 to 500,000 per year income range will get hit. And people below that and people above that will get a break. And even there, I don't think that Trump's, you know, resolution to tax reform would be, if he had his own way, it wouldn't be exactly what the congressional Republicans are coming up with, in the same way that, you know, repeal and replace Obamacare, you know, what he wanted was not what the congressional Republicans want. And, you know, I think he gives them enough rope to hang themselves with in order to allow all these things to play out and for his opponents to exhaust themselves and to put himself in the position of the grand negotiator in the end. And again, what does he want? He wants trade to be negotiated government to government bilaterally, not multilaterally, because he thinks that that's a bad bargaining position. And in a context of slowing global trade, by the way, that is happening. Global trade is slowing anyway. And I was just reading an article about how China used to import trash for recycling as part of their industrial push. And now they're not anymore. Right. And, you know, there's all sorts of things going on with respect to this. He wants repatriation of capital. He definitely wants an infrastructure program of some kind. He obviously wants the U.S. to exploit more of its energy resources, whether it's coal or oil or natural gas, whatever. He definitely wants a more aggressive industrial capitalist policy in the United States. Now, the means for doing that, I think he's open. I don't think that he has any sort of principled preferred path. You know, I don't think that he has like Obama's notion of recuperating American capitalism on a green economy. I think that Trump is like whatever works.
So in our last interview, you talked about a crisis at the center of American politics, and we've been talking about that. But you said that Sanders and Trump were both attractive to the center. That is like non-aligned, independent, non-ideological voters found both candidates attractive for various reasons. However, the center of the party is also could be thought of as representing variations on what I'll call the Washington consensus. That is, the center of the parties are what's best for capital. And so would you say there are two centers and that one is defined by the Washington consensus and the other is defined by the middle class or the working class? How aligned is the middle class and the working class with the interests of capital? And would you say that these normie voters, middle class voters, were more accepting of the political class and Washington consensus in the past, but they're disaffected, and they're disaffected maybe because capital has a new need. You know, there's a real shift in what's required, that the middle class and these working class voters are leading the way, not for revolutionary change or even in their own interest, but in the interest of what will make the system work.
Right, right. So there are at least two different aspects here. There's the center in terms of policy. There's like the policy spectrum and the center there. And then there's the center in terms of the electorate. And what I'd say is that what we experienced was a crisis of both. And not just in the 2016 election, but really going back to 2008 and maybe even in the last years of the George W. Bush administration, when the Iraq war started going badly, and certainly when the economic crisis hit. So from 2006 onward, you had a crisis of policy. In other words, a crisis of foreign policy, crisis of domestic policy, you know, crisis of policy. And that's a window for rethinking things. Obviously, it's a window of opportunity for rethinking things. But there was also a crisis of the electorate in the sense of, you know, how do we understand the elections within a margin of error, right, which we experienced for a while. We experienced it in 2000, 2004. There seemed to have been an end to that, a resolution of that crisis in 2008, but it was understood in very peculiar ways. It was understood as, with Obama's victory, as a demographic shift that would be of permanent benefit to the Democrats, and obviously that wasn't true. And you had it with Mitt Romney's gaffe in 2012 when he said, well, look, 47% of the electorate, we can never win, right, for various reasons, right? They're just entrenched Democrats in terms of the way the Democrats serve as interest aggregators. So, you know, that was his big gaffe. And now the very same numbers floated, right, to say that 47% of the electorate are just hopelessly Trump supporters. Right, the exact same number is used, right? It's interesting. And I think that, you know, so those are two different crises. One is consensus, right, whether explicit or tacit, because I'd also say that bipartisan gridlock, right, the impasse, the gridlock in Washington, is also a modus vivendi. In other words, it can be seen as entrenched positions that can't compromise, or it can be said that they actually serve each other because they implement what they want and they allow other things that they don't really care about to just stand as they are. So immigration, for example. So both parties claim to want immigration reform and they largely say that they want the same thing out of immigration reform. There's not very much difference between the immigration reform that's offered by the Republicans and the Democrats. But both parties actually benefit from nothing being done, because the Republicans can use it as a wedge issue and the Democrats can use it as a Latino vote gathering issue. And it's for them to do anything about it would actually undermine their position of electoral advantage. Right. Right. And so what Trump did was he broke the rules of the tacit modus vivendi by saying that he's actually going to implement what both parties have promised. And neither party really wants it to be implemented. That's the problem, right? It's to their disadvantage to actually implement the programs that they have promoted, right? So that's why I say that, you know, the thing about Trump is that he basically says, okay, both parties have promised these things over the years, but neither have been able to deliver it. And there's this impasse and deadlock, and I'm actually going to do it. And they're like, oh, but you don't understand. This is what we promised the electorate without actually intending to do it. Right?
But okay, here's my question for you, though. Is there any kind of correlation between what is needed to maintain the capitalist system and what works itself out to the benefit of the politicians? In other words, there's a certain kind of economy of the impasse here where it's serving their political needs, but that doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, the ship could sink while they're all very happy.
It's tricky because I'd say that, you know, first of all, capital, right, the capitalists, they benefit no matter what. Let's be clear about that. They benefit no matter what.
Well, that's not true, because in 2008, the capitalists didn't really benefit from the crisis. Some of them might have, but, you know, there were many businesses that went away, and there was a real crisis for mm-hmm. capital itself, mm-hmm. not just for working people.
Well, when a business fails, right, the capitalists get their money. They do.
Yeah.
The people lose their jobs, but the capitalists keep their money. You know, in other words, they might take a haircut, so to speak. In other words, they might have $100 billion in investments and come out with $70 billion. But that's not a real loss.
Right. Well, but even there, like the capitalists as a class, their individual interest is not the same as the interest of the total class of capital.
That's right. But then you're getting into a much more kind of abstract realm, in which case we're not just talking about the capitalist. In other words, we're not talking about the investor class. Because after all, I was just teaching Marx, Das Kapital, the working class is itself a form of fixed capital. Right? When Marx talks about the destruction of capital, that also includes, workers being thrown out of work and
starving.
Well,
yeah, I get technically they're not fixed capital, but they're certainly an investment that the investing class has to make in variable capital. But yeah.
Well, they're not circulating capital. So it's fixed and circulating versus constant and variable. So they're not circulating capital. They're fixed capital. They're not constant capital, but they are fixed capital. They're variable capital as opposed to constant capital, but they're not circulating capital. Right. So, again, the destruction of capital from a Marxist standpoint includes the workers. It includes the workers. And so when we talk about the interests of capital, we're also talking about the working class. Right? We got to get away from this vulgar Marxism that equates capital with the money bags. Right? That's not capital.
Right, right. Yeah. And this is why it's such a trick to have a radical emancipatory project amongst the working class, because their actual immediate interests are often enough aligned with the interests of capital.
That's right. And so, again, I was just rereading Debs. I have a recent article in the Platypus Review on the end of the Gilded Age. And what's interesting about Debs's rhetoric in 1900 was that it's not at all clear that he's more sympathetic to the Democrats than to the Republicans. In other words, he describes the Democrats and the Republicans. He describes the Republicans as the self-congratulation of big capital. And he describes the Democrats as the wail of the dying middle class. Right? And so, and he says that what social democracy represents is the working class's economic freedom, which, by the way, big capital composed as that, as against the middle class conservatives. Big capital composed as economic freedom for the workers.
They do.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's real. In other words, that's not a lie. That's real. Obviously, cap politics is about tying people's interests to big capital in various ways. And so the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats is how they tie the middle class and the working class to the interests of big capital. So there are different ways of doing it. There are different ways of configuring politics to line people up behind the interests of big capital. And of course, big capital itself can have differences in terms of which direction to go, right? And that can be not only the direction of investments. In other words, it doesn't only have to follow where Wall Street goes, but, all sorts of middle management, industrial planners, government bureaucrats can have their own vision of the direction that society can and should go in. And big unions too, right? Big unions also have visions of proper social investment. They have policies that they pursue too, other than their own direct interests.
Right. And so I guess the way I've been thinking is that there's one unified interest for capital. But in fact, it is, as I really should have known and did know somewhere deep down, it is as full of contradictions and at war with itself just as much as we're at war with ourselves in the realm of the superstructure.
And the way that I put it, to bring it back around to Trump, is, he has these kind of very naive claims, right, that I think are sincere. So he's like, well, we should renegotiate trade with China integration with Mexico. And if we do so properly, it will be to the benefit not only of the United States, but also of China and Mexico. It will be better for everyone. And I don't think that that's demagoguery or lying. I think he actually believes that. You know, make Mexico great again also. But he believes that, a better regime of immigration, of managing immigration between the government of Mexico and the government of the United States will be to the benefit of both Mexican and American society. And similarly with trade with China. And I think that that's, that attempt to say everyone can benefit, that is the essence of capitalist politics.
It's also the essence of socialism to a degree.
Yes.
But I'm going to – forgive me for being a pundit or like pretend like I'm on MSNBC all of a sudden. Okay, you say that he believes this sincerely. Then explain Trump's racism. Why does he say all these terrible things about Mexicans and Chinese people and everyone else if he really is sincerely wanting to raise up everyone?
Oh, because, he makes the distinction that any conservative would make, which was between the good people and the bad people. Namely, when he says, look, immigration is fine, but what about the drug gangs who control the border?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, there's a point to that, right? Which is to say that there is such a thing as drug gangs and human trafficking and all of that. There is. That's a reality of any immigrant community has its organized crime as a very important constituency of its social reality. You could go back to the Italian mafia. It's just that's reality. And, again, he sees that as a problem. It serves both purposes, which is to say, it serves as a demagogical rallying cry, this kind of law and order conservatism. And it also serves as a basis for negotiation between governments, because he can say to the Mexican government, don't you want to defeat the drug traffickers too?
What I've noticed about Trump and how he operates is that he throws the opposition into irrationality by saying these things. So, for instance, around his statements, that Mexicans are rapists. If you look into what he's talking about the rate of rapes amongst illegal immigrants and the people who are trying to get into this country. Women are often subjected to sexual abuse and rape, and it's really an astronomical figure. Now, it's not that the immigrants are rapists. It's that you have an illegal criminal gangs or a bunch of them set up to get humans out of Mexico and into the United States illegally. So you're going through the gauntlet. You're going through the darkest aspect of society to get across that border, and you're opening yourself up to all sorts of abuse. A left-wing approach to this would be to say, yes, it's absolutely true that, there's a horrible rate of rape amongst illegal immigrants, but we need to understand why, and we need to have a rational approach to making more immigration possible so that and also addressing some of the problems that are in Mexico economically that makes it necessary for people to run for the border. We have to have some address all these big problems. We can't just say the Mexicans are all great and how dare you say that.
That's right. And you have with the sanctuary cities debate the same problem, which is to say you have police agencies, local police agencies saying we need a modus vivendi with the gangs. And if you try to crack down on immigration too much, you're going to make it impossible for us to enforce law and order to the degree to which we can at all within these immigrant communities, because the immigrant communities won't cooperate with us. And what they mean by that is the modus vivendi that the police have with the gangs. And which, by the way, the Border Patrol also has with the drug traffickers, right? Because they can't, the police can never fight all the criminals all the time. They have to pick their battles. And that's always a political calculus. And that's why it's always connected to the corruption of politicians. It's a deeply embedded phenomenon on both sides of the border. What socialists would do is offer something entirely different. In other words, what socialists would do would be to say, we're going to conduct policy. You know what the old socialists used to do? I was reminded of this by Bill Peltz, who recently passed away, in fact, the historian of American socialism and of international socialism, Bill Peltz, at an event that I put on here in Chicago, that the socialists simply ran in local elections as the non-corrupt politicians.
Wouldn't matter which party they were attached to, or they're attached to their own party?
The Socialist Party of America. They ran the way they defeated the Republicans and the Democrats is simply by saying we're not corrupt. Right? It was just as straightforward as that, meaning that they were going to be the totally above board, purely legal politicians as opposed to the politicians who are really mired in, you know, what Foucault called tolerated illegalities.
Right.
Meaning, you know, the law is not uniformly enforced at all. Right. Like we need to be clear. We don't, you know, that's the demagogy of Trump, is that he's this law and order conservative, to which the politicians can only say, but we don't really live in a law and order state. That's impossible.
I'm a first generation American, and my dad came from what I guess Trump would call a shithole. And he was able to make a living and raise a family in the United States to become a very proud American. And second of all, what I think of Chris today is all over this country, you have decent people who sit down with their kids at the dinner table and they say, judge people based on their character. Don't judge people based on the color of their skin or the country that they came from. Whether or not they have an accent or not, judge them on whether they are good human beings. And we have a president today, the leader of our nation, telling the whole world that that's not what he does.
When we spoke last, you said that you thought that there'll be a socially conservative shift in the country, that people would be returning to more socially conservative cultural values under Trump. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
I wasn't sure about that in terms of the traditional way that one thinks of social conservatism. I think that that is in itself undergoing a shift. And I think that a lot of the sex panic that we're seeing right now is social conservatism. It is. It's extremely patriarchal to discipline men for sexual infractions. That's a very conservative, patriarchal position to take. You know, men have always loved condemning other men for their sexual infractions. Protecting women is a very patriarchal, conservative position. And that's why, you know, you have the right wing is saying, see, it all started when we tolerated Clinton. Right. When we said that Clinton's behavior was merely personal, that opened the door to all this abuse. Right. The right is always there to say, see, we told you.
The people who are the strongest voices in this sexual harassment, I don't want to say panic, but I don't know what else to call it.
Concern.
There you go. Seem to be on the left, you know, at least in the Democratic side, on the Democratic side of the aisle. And the repercussions are mostly being felt amongst liberal elites. I mean, yeah, Roy Moore didn't win, but he ran, you know. And,
right.
And meanwhile, Al Franken, who I don't like, had to step down because he was apparently patting people's butts during photo shoots, maybe a couple of times. And it was, you know, that was the allegation that he denied, and he still had to step down. It was a very strange moment.
It is a very strange phenomenon, and it comes down to, like, again, ethics. It's very strange what's going on right now, and it's unclear what's actually driving it, ultimately. But it does seem like, we can at least say at an ideological level, Trump is seen as the harasser-in-chief, right? The groper-in-chief,
right?
You know, maybe even a rapist. You know, I mean, most of the allegations against him have been along the same lines as, you know, what we're seeing prevalent in the culture now. You know, sort of inappropriate behavior.
Right.
You know, creepiness.
Yeah.
You know, did he go into the dressing rooms of Miss America contestants?
He said he did on Howard Stern.
Of course, yeah, because, you know, he's the proprietor. Of course he's going to be walking through the dressing rooms. Of course he's going to be around backstage, of course. I remember I read one testimonial where the woman said that she was naked under a robe. And I'm like, well, then you weren't naked. Right? We're all naked under, because she said he walked in while I was still naked under my robe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, not to be too cynical about it, but I do think that there's at least the idea that they're going to try to tar, the Democrats are going to try to tar the Republicans with Trump's sexual reputation in the 2018. I mean, that's why it's all about women voters now. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Barack Obama or Michelle Obama or whomever, the plea that's being made, you know, is Michelle Obama. Since we last spoke, who gave a major speech saying that women who voted for Trump were voting against themselves, right? And so, you know, in a margin of error world, you know, the question is, how can you shave a, you know, half a percentage point off your opponent?
Yeah, but that was such a bad
and so
strategy.
They,
last time, that was such a poor strategy. I mean, they did this already, and they lost. And I maybe they'll win this next time, I guess, double down, but it just seems like there's a better solution, which is to try to get, you know, people's votes because they want to vote for you.
Yes. The other point is that whether we're living in a post-60s moment, in the sense that I think it's inevitable that we will eventually live in a world in which conservative women vote for conservatives and liberal women vote for liberals and conservative blacks vote for conservatives and liberal blacks vote for liberals, you know, that it's just going to come down like that. In other words, this would be this assumption, because in my lifetime, which is your lifetime as well, you know, I always like to that the reason that Bill and Hillary didn't support gay marriage is not because they didn't support it themselves. They did. They just didn't want to lose the black vote over it.
Right.
Because the black voters were against it.
Yeah.
And what losing the black vote would have meant is not black voters voting for Republicans. It would have meant black voters not turning out.
Right.
That's what it means.
Yeah.
It's, and so, like, here in Chicago, it was the black aldermen who were always against gay marriage.
Yeah.
And so the Democrats, why were they slow on the gay marriage thing? It was not because they didn't support it in their heart of hearts. It's because it was an electoral problem for them.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. My question is that how does this connect, going back to our conversation on a deeper level, to the change in neoliberalism and what capital is trying to work out? I mean, can we map on these sorts of social values arguments onto constituencies within capital? Could we say that the Me Too movement is serving this sector of capital, whether it's workers or capitalists or middle management or whoever?
There is a question of cultural norms, you know, what everyone can agree upon, in the sense of both in terms of like legal liability, lawsuits, that whole world, in terms of the labor, in terms of professional behavior, but also in terms of, you know, rhetoric and ideology, you know, how we talk about these things. You know, in other words, that all women should be believed, except, of course, we don't really mean that, right? What we mean is all women should be believed in the sense of all women should be able to make their allegation, whether it's false or not. Right? No. Like, this is the discourse now. The discourse is believe all women means they all have a right to make their allegation. And I'm like, that's a strange way of dealing with it rhetorically, right? It's like, of course, everyone has a right to make an allegation, but that doesn't mean that you believe the allegation. It just means that you say that people have a right to make it.
But yeah, but then you have to do some investigation to prove whether the allegations are true or not. I mean,
right.
But
it's a strange rhetoric, though, that we have now, believe all women.
But I think the thought is that I think the people who say it think that almost all of the, like 99.99% of the allegations are true.
And that might be true. That might be true. Who was the Supreme, very famous American who said, who's the guy who said it's better for one guilty, 100 guilty men go free than that one innocent person be convicted?
Right. That's being reversed. That's when you say believe all women, you are also saying it's better for one innocent man to go to jail than let 100 guilty men go free. I think that and some people have said maybe. That.
Some people have said that, but I think that that's also maybe not a literal position, but it's almost like a way of dismissing the threat of wrongful accusation. I don't know how much they would really stand by that as a practical matter.
They wouldn't stand by it in any other context.
Right.
I feel like the response to like Garrison Keillor and Louis C.K. I like Louis C.K., not a big fan of Garrison Keillor, mm-hmm. but in both cases, I feel like it was well off the charts for – it was like a very big overreaction to what the allegations actually were if you look at them.
Yeah, it's a little impenetrable, meaning everything is kind of contextual. And so the way things sound from the outside, you know, it's kind of like, okay, this seems like creepy behavior, or conversely, it seems like innocent behavior. But in the context, who knows, right? And so it's, you know, again, I think that it comes down to the hostile work environment criterion, which is very elastic. And, you know, in terms of campus, like Title IX enforcement, right, the idea is that colleges and universities are obligated to create a non-hostile environment for women, meaning an environment in which women don't feel discriminated against. And so, again, that's something that can't actually be legally established, but the law has to accommodate shifting social norms, right? Going back to like classical liberalism, it's kind of like the definition of pornography, right, or of obscenity, right, which is that you know it when you see it, meaning there is no strict legal definition. It's more of a community norm definition to be decided by juries, essentially.
But now it's not being decided by juries. It's being decided by media and Twitter and social media.
And that's because it's not being decided legally at all. People are just being hounded.
Right. So, and is this new, or am I just because it seems like it's certainly not new if you mean by new this year. But even like, is it new to the 21st century?
I think it's periodic. I think that we have these sex moral panics periodically, and I think that it's a feature of capitalism in the sense that capitalism involves a great deal of social dislocation and changing of norms, and a lot of high degree, high pace of change that creates, you know, fissures between generations. And so it literally is like what was acceptable 10 years ago is no longer acceptable now, or vice versa. What was unacceptable 10 years ago is now acceptable, you know. And so it's a, you know, curious thing. I think it's a periodic feature of capitalism that you have these moral panics of various kinds, usually of a sexual nature, but not always. I mean, obviously the drug, there have been drug panics. There are all sorts of panics at a moral level.
It's hard not to see this as a victory for the left for me because of a certain kind of left. Because I've, you know, since the 90s been hanging around the left in some way or another. And the idea of affirmative consent and very elastic definitions of sexual harassment has been around since the 90s.
Let me put it in terms of like, because one of the things that came up with the Roy Moore election was the abortion issue. Right. And, you know, how we understand the abortion issue. Because, you know, I think that, again, it becomes a kind of referendum on attitude and morality. And I think that one of the brilliant strokes that Trump made was that he understands that you just have to respect people's values. You don't have to actually change policy. In other words, you just have to say abortion is wrong and you don't have to actually do anything about it. You just have to intone it, right? No, in the sense that people want to feel that their values are respected. And I think that that's obviously a very dangerous place for politics to be. But you also see it in other domains. In other words, it's like Black Lives Matter. It's like, okay, we're not actually going to decrease the amount of police violence against, but as a public, we're going to condemn it. We're going to say that we respect the victims, even though we're not going to really be able to do anything about their victimization.
If you'll join us in this song, I think you'll recognize it when I start it. Let me get a card. Always remember, others may hate you. Those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
Richard Nixon died today.
That's just plain poppycock. And then you destroy yourself.
I saw it on the news, they said.
Well, I'm not a crook.
He was the president everybody hated.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. Crook, crook.
And I don't dream about the president anymore.
Crook, crook. As a flower, she grew.
And all of my friends, they say that they don't either.
Crook, crook. And as a fair young flower, she died.
Richard Nixon died today.
Poppycock.
I saw it on the news, they said.
Because people have got to know.
Oh, I guess he was okay.
Their president's a crook.
I'm watching history remade.
Crook.
He went to a special place in heaven.
I have never obstructed justice.
Call your Belinda.
We don't have a good word for it in English. Poppycock.
I don't dream about the president anymore.
Crook, crook, as a flower she grew.
And most of my friends, they say that they don't either.
Crook, crook, and as a fair young flower she died.
Richard Nixon died today.
That's just plain poppycock. We'll see you again.
Richard Nixon died today.
We'll see you again. We'll see you again. We'll see you again. Au revoir.
You seem to consider neoliberalism as a political project rather than as an attempt to manage the economy. But maybe this question has been answered earlier on in a way. But as a Marxist myself or a wannabe one, I tend to think of neoliberalism as a set of not always coherent policies, economic policies, and whereas you say that democracy and capitalism are in conflict, again, treating capitalism as if it's political rather than an economic category, I would say that democracy is sometimes good at handling the demands that capitalism puts on it and sometimes is bad at it as a management strategy. Well, what do you think neoliberalism is? And is it something more than just a set of policies and an approach towards managing the contradictions of capitalism?
Neoliberalism in the strict sense of like Jeffrey Sachs, Milton Friedman, there is that kind of neoliberalism that has like a specific kind of economics to it. And so what Foucault keyed into there was that this wasn't mere economics. In other words, that it had a whole notion of human nature and society built in. That biopolitics was built into neoliberal economics. And he was right about that. I prefer, you know, David Harvey's way of addressing, you know, the regimes of accumulation that are simultaneously economic, cultural, political, and his concept of post-Fordism that's bound up with that. In other words, the Fordist capital was not only an economic change from liberal capital, but also a political and cultural change, and that neoliberalism, or what he called the condition of postmodernity, how he described that as post-Fordism was similarly a change in the regime of accumulation that involves changes in politics, culture, and economics. And also that it's a change that's not just a break, but there's continuity as well. And so neoliberalism, you know, neo and liberalism, one thing that I like to emphasize to help illustrate this is that not only neoconservatism, but also neoliberalism came out of the Democratic Party. They're all ex-Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important thing because it has to do with the way we understand changes since the 60s. What made the neoliberals and the neoconservatives come out of the Democratic Party is precisely the crisis of the New Deal coalition in the 60s. And out of it come neoconservatism and neoliberalism. The neo, that's important. But the fact that they both came out of the Democratic Party is significant because if we describe the mid-20th century as a regime of accumulation that was ruled, governed by the Democratic Party, the New Deal coalition, then we have to understand not only the economic conditions for politics, but also the political conditions for economics.
Yeah, so this is, I think, where I start to have difficulties because I feel as though your politics are always going to be the politics are always going to be trailing behind the economic demands, even if the economic demands are conflicted. Maybe this is where there's some sort of a solution for me, is that because the economic conditions or demands are not actually uniform, the solutions that get put forward can be are never going to be right either. There's no right way to solve the problem. So they can lead the economy because they can, you know, make a choice can be made that's not – no, there is no one rational choice. And then that can have its own economic that does have its own economic consequences.
Consequences, absolutely. I mean, that's why, you know, I feel like, you know, an old debate in Marxism was, did Keynesianism really work? And how do we understand how Keynesianism worked? Did the New Deal work, or was it World War II that saved capitalism? Was it the destruction of capital in World War II?
Well, I tend to be the destruction of capitalism guy, you know, a destruction of capital guy.
That's the orthodox position. That's like the Ernest Mandel position. But at the same time, it's clear that Keynesianism as a policy helped shape what came out of World War II. In other words, it didn't. The question is not whether it worked as economics, but rather how it shaped the ideological and political landscape.
And what, when there was a boom again, what, where that boom was, and how the money that was being produced again through capitalist exploitation, when that could happen again, well, where that money was directed.
Mm-hmm. And that's Fordism, too. In other words, to understand it as both Keynesianism and Fordism, and then you have the whole problem of military Keynesianism and whether that was true not only in the 50s and 60s, but also under Reagan in the 80s, whether there was a kind of military Keynesianism at work. You know, these kinds of questions, Keynesianism and Fordism, and I'll just point out that Milton Friedman declared right before the crisis of 73, you know, we're all Keynesians anyway. Right. So he didn't understand his own project as anti-Keynesian either. And I always also like to bring up the Mount Berlin Society meeting after World War II, where Ludwig von Mises shows up and condemns everyone there, including Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and the young Milton Friedman and others like Isaiah Berlin, Karl Popper. He condemns them all as socialists. Right, the ordo-liberals were condemned by von Mises as being socialists. He was exasperated. He said, oh, I thought I was coming to the anti-socialist conference, but you're all socialists, meaning that they all basically accepted certain political realities and, you know, and didn't think that they could be changed. They also didn't think that they should be changed. You know, again, what you said earlier I want to key into, which is the nature of change in capitalism. If we go back to Marx, the idea that the ideological superstructure changes more slowly than the socioeconomic base. It's not about the economic base determining the ideological superstructure, but rather the fact that the ideological superstructure always lags behind. the socioeconomic base. And the socioeconomic base can't be defined by the interests of the capitalist, but has to be defined in terms of the concrete changes necessitated by the dynamics of
capitalism. Is right. What you said, right? Yeah,
right.
You just cut out for a second there. Even if some of your analysis is completely wrong, I think it's important for people to hear it and not to hear it only on the register of, you know, what is this guy's moral position? Like, why was he soft on Trump? He must, you know, love Trump, or he must love or hate Mexicans, or, you know, that's just.
So I'll tell you what I love about Trump, because I do love Trump. What do I love about him? I love the wrecking ball. I love the fact that he's making things visible, and that there's a way, at least possibly, you know, again, I was foolish enough in 2015 to pick up his books, The Art of the Deal and Crippled America, How to Make America Great Again, and read them. And he's just following the script of those books. And so it's pretty transparently clear what's going on, to me anyway, because it's kind of like, okay, he's just doing what he said he was going to do, and he's doing it how he said he does it. And, you know, just ignoring all of the Democratic Party propaganda and also the established Republican Party propaganda, his ignoring of that rhetoric is not some extremist position. It's just a stylistic dissent. And it finds a lot of resonance because, you know, most people fully acculturated to, nor do they really care about this carefully constructed, what you were talking about the consensus, you know, or political care, not because they don't care about people or care about people's sufferings, but because they can't be bothered with the nuances of rhetoric.
It's really important to get beyond rhetoric and to try to think about things critically.
The challenge is, you know, with respect to rhetoric, it does unfortunately come down to what is to be done. Meaning that rhetoric aside, what are we actually proposing here? And, you know, and of course, by what we're proposing here, that's very freighted because the left is in no position to propose anything. You know, and so, you know, it comes down to how do we understand changes in capitalism and its ideological expression. I'm of two minds about something like Black Lives Matter, for instance. I do think that the carceral state, the mass incarceration, the draconian drug sentencing, and all this stuff that we've had for a generation, I think it's pretty much unsustainable and unworkable. And so I do think that from within mainstream politics, there's going to be a move to curtail the police and to curtail the carceral state. I could be wrong about that, but at least it seems possible that that could happen, right? And so it's not going to happen because white people wake up and recognize how bad they are and how white supremacist they are. That's not how it's going to happen. And it's not even going to be primarily facilitated by that either. And so I think that the disjuncture between the rhetoric and the reality is very significant, meaning that you know, it's simply, you know, the carceral state doesn't work. It doesn't work as social policy. It doesn't particularly work. I guess you could say it works as politics because some rural communities in the South love and taking prisoners from the North and, you know, creating little industries. That doesn't seem like a driving factor. It seems like a kind of knock-on benefit for some, you know, marginal communities. You know, it doesn't seem like, okay, white people have an interest in incarcerating black people because it's a growth industry, you know? And so it seems to me that, you know, the increased consciousness around police brutality, which is also police brutality against white people, you know, like the poor guy who was crawling on the floor and got shot, right? And I'm just like, you know, obviously the Black Lives Matter moment could have been a moment of increased awareness of the unworkability of the draconian police state that we live under. Or it can be turned into a cheap vote-getting racket for the Democrats.
And that's what happened, you feel.
Yeah. And for me, that's like, you know, if you care about reality, you need to care about that disparity.
Yeah, I just feel like right now it's even harder to care about reality if you're on the left than ever. And because there's so many pressures to get you basically to intone.
To intone the ritual pieties. And it's sad because people don't realize that that's where the Democrats get us. You know, I think that I said this in our last interview. You know, from a personal perspective, of course, it would have been better for Hillary to have won. It would be better for the Democrats to win because, you know, I have all sorts of interests. And just in terms of, you know, or even just flattering myself, you know, as like, oh, you know, I live in a society that's tolerant of me as a gay person. You know, just, you know, on all sorts of levels in terms of like money in the bank and feeling good about myself, the Democrats are my party, of course. Now, that says nothing about my interest in socialism and my consciousness as a Marxist, right?
No, that's all just your personal life. That's like who you are in this society as an individual.
Yeah, and I feel like politics has to transcend one's personal individual self. You know, in other words, you have to sort of care about the common good. And obviously, I'm very wedded. You know, I got bit by the bug of Marxism at an early age. It infected my mind. I can't quite lose it. You know, my sense of like there's something fundamentally wrong here to which other problems can be traced without being reducible. Right. But, you know, there's a contradiction, and that contradiction takes a myriad of forms and has horrific consequences for people individually and collectively. And, you know, is not identical with my personal, like the need to change that is not immediately personal interests or affinities.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really tricky one to organize around. I mean, right. Especially now.
You have to, I think in the old days, like socialism appealed to people in their better self. It appealed to them. It appealed to a spirit of self-sacrifice in a larger, greater interest. I think people did believe that they were serving a greater interest, not just their own interests. And that's, I think that politics today still actually does that. In other words, in whatever, you know, measly way, right? Even with Trump, when he said, look, I didn't need to be president. I was doing just fine. I decided I needed to serve my country. People are like, oh, that's just a horrible lie. He must be interested in some tax break that will benefit him as a billionaire. And I'm like, but what if he actually meant it, right? Because I believe that he means it. I also believe when Hillary says the same thing. In other words, I don't think that Hillary wanted to be president just to line the pockets of the Clinton Foundation. She obviously believes she was serving a greater purpose, right?
Right.
These people believe that they're serving a greater purpose. The only problem is that they concede so much to what they think is an unchangeable reality.
Right.
That's only problem.
Well, yeah, that's a big one. And we do it all ourselves all the time.